Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, October 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, 13 days till the election, Donald Trump celebrates his new hotel down the street from the White House.
With the notable exception of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, this is the most coveted piece of real estate in Washington, D.C.
Could there be a new front in Syria to take on Islamic State? Are smartphones making people dumber? Also ahead, how Americans are planning for Halloween. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, as the November 8th election comes closer, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are focused on a handful of so-called battleground states that will determine who will be the next president of the United States. The U.S. elects a president through the state-by-state accumulation of electoral college votes. The candidate who wins the popular vote in any given state is awarded that state's electoral votes. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a look at the battle for those swing states.
In the final days of the campaign, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are frequent visitors to the same handful of states, whether it's Trump in Ohio and New Hampshire or Clinton in Florida and Nevada. For several years now, the United States has been sharply divided politically in presidential elections. Political expert Stephen Wayne.
In many states, one party has a very big lead, and there's no sense in spending a lot of resources at the presidential level in that state.
That leaves about a dozen so-called battleground or swing states where the presidential candidates spend most of their time, says expert Jeremy Mayer.
In the modern presidential campaign, you run campaigns only in about 12 states. The list can change from year to year, although in the last three election cycles, it's fairly stable.
The swing states that get the most attention include large states like Florida and Ohio, as well as smaller ones like North Carolina, Nevada, and New Hampshire. Since the 1992 election won by Bill Clinton, Democrats have generally had more success in winning key swing states. And that makes it challenging for Trump this year, says analyst Austin Hart.
He's got to win voters in Florida, Ohio, perhaps Colorado and Nevada. He's got to shore up things in Pennsylvania if he can. So he has a heavy load in front of him.
Folks, we're run by people that are not smart people.
In the final days of the campaign, candidates target a relatively small group of voters in a handful of states, says expert Jennifer Lawless.
The question is now that sliver of independence. But it's not only the sliver of independence, it's smaller than that. It's the sliver of independence who live in battleground states. So we're talking about a very, very small percentage of the population.
Polls show Clinton leading nationally and in several key battleground states, though Trump remains competitive in a few key states like Ohio, Florida, and North Carolina. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
So how does a candidate's personality play a role in getting them elected? I'm joined by political psychologist Dr. Bart Rossi. What exactly is a winning personality, and how does that play into a voter's final decision?
A winning personality, to me, involves a number of different features. First off, you have to be comfortable in who you are. You cannot pretend to be somebody else. I never thought Romney, for example, was comfortable in his own skin. I certainly thought McCain was. I also thought Obama was is comfortable in his own skin. Also, you need to be consistent. You ought to be consistent on the issues, whether you're on the right or the left.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be fairly, you don't have to be perfect, but reasonably consistent. You don't want to be a flip-flopper. Number three, you want to approach everybody. Ronald Reagan approached everybody and all groups of people. Even if he disagreed with them, he would respectfully disagree and say, why? I'm on the other side of this for these reasons. And fourth, you need to project yourself like you're going to be a good listener. If you met Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton, you would probably get the impression that they would actually listen to you and respond to your question. And that is very important, and many politicians don't get that.
What about the current candidates? Are they good listeners?
I think one of them probably is a good listener, and that would be Hillary Clinton. And I do think she has winning traits. Those winning traits she does have. However, In her case, this whole election cycle, she's had this cloud over her head, this huge cloud of believability and trustworthiness. That's actually been the first issue with her, rather than even the winning personality traits that I think she does possess. And the other candidate is someone who does not listen. I don't think he listens to anybody but himself, and I think that's been demonstrated on the national stage. He also doesn't really approach any groups of people or organizations except the ones he wants to approach: Hispanics, immigrants, immigrant families, women. And most certainly, he discards anybody who believes in climate change, because they're part of a liberal hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. Kind of hard to make that up. He actually says these things and expects to win an election by discarding all of these people. So I don't see the winning personality traits with Trump, except for one. He is very comfortable in his own skin. He's very comfortable being the boss, the authoritarian personality. He plays the authoritarian personality. He believes he's the boss guy, and people do relate to that, and he has his own sector of the population.
Did you see anything else that was interesting pertaining to their body language during the debates?
Yes, especially in the second one. The second debate was a town hall debate, and you could see that Hillary Clinton walked up to the people delivering the questions, and she spoke directly to them, remembered their name, and answered the question with a smile, and was very effective, I thought, in using her body to convey some confidence and empathy and connection to the people who were asking questions. At the same time, you saw Donald Trump walking around the stage. His head was down at times. His hands were up against the chair, and he looked like he was brooding. He was squinting as he answered some of the questions, looking angry and frustrated. And his facial expressions, to me, looked like somebody who was perplexed and agitated at times. Two very different scenarios in terms of body language. One quite positive, maybe not perfect, but the other one really looking angry and brooding.
Do you think there's any comparison to these two candidates with any others that we've ever seen in our history?
Well, they're very different in the sense that Hillary Clinton has this cloud over her, which I don't think we've seen, this cloud of believability. I think some of it is her own fault. Some of it has actually been effectively manufactured by the other side and thrown at her. And actually, when it's thrown at her, she hasn't really deflected it as well as she could. That's something that's quite unique. I think that may continue in the future for new candidates as we go forward because of social media. On the other side, we have never seen anybody like this. I have never, ever seen anybody who I thought was not competent, not capable, and dangerous if he became president. I would never think of Romney or McCain or Jeb Bush. I wouldn't think of having a conversation about their mental stability or about a personality disorder. I see Donald Trump at this point in the context of political psychology as someone who I think actually presents as if he has a mental health / personality disorder.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective, political psychologist Dr. Bart Rossi. Speaking of social media, let's turn now to G. Abby Lee. Hey, G, what's going on?
Hi, Lori.
What do you have for us today?
Let's begin with a story from Pakistan that's been trending worldwide. Lori, do you remember the girl with striking green eyes who graced the cover of National Geographic a few decades ago?
No.
That was a very iconic photo for the magazine, and the media usually refer to her as the Afghan girl. And 30 years later, of course, she is no longer a young woman. She's an Afghan refugee in Pakistan, and her name is Sherbat Gula.
Wow. So why is she trending again today?
Because of the news that she's facing up to 14 years in prison over allegations of using fake ID. That's a pretty harsh term for fake ID. Mm-hmm. A human rights activist based in Europe tweeted, "She has been arrested for possessing false documentation," and attached a current photo of her, and you can still see she has that harrowing look in her eyes. A Pakistani resident tweeted, "Her arrest is the latest episode in ongoing campaign of harassment of Afghan refugees by Islamabad." But others argued, hey, forging ID is illegal, period.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of buzz around the U.S. presidential election, too.
Absolutely. And that's going to be the case for the next two more weeks, for sure. You took a deep breath right now.
Yes, I did.
Let's begin with the Republican candidate Donald Trump. He's in D.C. to promote his new hotel just several blocks away from where we are. Although Trump pulling out of the campaign trail raised some eyebrows, his team touted it as an example of what he would like to bring to other buildings down the street. The building used to be Washington's old post office.
Okay, and what about Hillary Clinton? Wednesday was her birthday, right?
It was, and you can see photos of her looking delighted in front of a birthday cake surrounded by her campaign staff. Her family members and running mate Tim Kaine shared birthday messages on Twitter. And this is what her husband, former President Bill Clinton, tweeted. Happy birthday, Hillary, in all of you today and every day. So cute.
Aww.
Lori, back to you.
All right. Thank you so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A major U.S. media merger faces questions from investors and regulators. Two temblors shake central Italy near the site of the deadly August quake. The first women graduate U.S. Army Infantry Officer course. And original emojis will be exhibited at a New York museum. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. International Edition continues now in the fight against Islamic State. Army Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, the top U.S. military commander in Iraq, said Wednesday that Kurdish militia fighters will likely be included as part of the force to isolate the IS-held Syrian city of Raqqa. The terror group is using Raqqa as its main stronghold as a base to plan and launch attacks against targets abroad.
It's a very complicated battle space. There are a lot of regional security concerns that are in competition there. The Syrian regime's involved. The Russians are involved. Turkey's involved. It's hard. And there's a civil war going on right next door. So it's going to be a tough, political environment and a security environment, I think, for our effort there.
VOA's Victor Beatty talks about the strategy with David Lesh, professor of history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas.
Strategically, it makes sense, if we're able to do so, to hit both Mosul and Raqqa, if not at the same time, at the same time, just to make sure that, you know, those members of the Islamic State that are fleeing Mosul are not able to acquire a safe haven in Raqqa. However, I mean, the political implications are very, very complicated, because in Syria, northern Syria, you have to deal with the Kurdish situation, the Turks, the Russians. There's so many players involved that you have to basically politically, you know, settle the situation before you actually enter into the military equation. For instance, the force that the U.S.-led coalition would most rely on the ground are the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are mostly made up of Kurdish groups and some Arab groups. But these Kurdish groups are at odds with Turkey, and in fact, in a little mini war with Turkish forces. And I think the U.S. Has been trying to work with Turkey and to try to settle these matters and differences before any assault on Raqqa is implemented. But a lot of political differences with groups on the ground, with regional players, of course, making sure that the forces are separated from where Russia operates so as to deconflict the area. All of these things in Raqqa have to be settled before engaging in an offensive, as opposed to Mosul. Not that that politically is easier, but it's militarily much more straightforward than it is in Raqqa.
Of course, the as you indicated, the landscape is so much different from Iraq. In Iraq, you have a central government to deal with, whereas in Syria, you really don't.
Well, exactly. The U.S.-led coalition and our allies on the ground would, in fact, be working, in effect, on the same side as the Syrian government and its Iranian and Russian backers. Yet, we don't necessarily want to and cannot, you know, on the surface, work with those groups to take on the Islamic State. So it's a very unique and somewhat odd situation in Syria in that regard, whereas in Iraq, as you said, it's much more straightforward. The U.S. is supporting the Iraqi government and trying to evict the Islamic State from Mosul and hopefully from the rest of Iraq. In Syria, it's just such a complicated situation. It's probably doable, but there's a lot of negotiation that remains. And particularly, in my mind, the most central feature of this is trying to work out the U.S. relationship in this triangular situation with the Kurds, our Kurdish allies on the ground, and the country of Turkey.
Well, the General Townsend did indicate that the Kurdish YPG militia, which is, of course, opposed by Turkey, will be part of this rebel group. What other groups might also be involved?
Well, there are some, Arab, indigenous Syrian Arab forces, some Free Syrian Army forces, some other groups that have been supported by U.S., both Kurdish and Arab. You know, by far, the Syrian Democratic Forces, who have been the most effective group fighting the Islamic State on the ground in Syria, are largely made up of YPG elements who have been attacked by Turkish forces in recent weeks. So that really needs to be worked out.
That's David Lesh, professor of history at Trinity University. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Join us for VOA's coverage of the most important U.S. political event of the year. Americans will decide who their next president will be. We'll have all the context, commentary, and analysis with our coverage of the U.S. presidential election. Right here on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues now. So in this day and age of technology, it seems like wherever you turn, people are buried in their cell phones, whether it's on the subway or in a restaurant or just walking down the street. So what is it doing to relationships? Joining me now, New York-based psychotherapist and author of the book Be Fearless, Change Your Life in 28 Days, Jonathan Alpert. You wrote an article titled, Are Smartphones Making Us Dumber? Are they?
Phones are good and bad. Of course, there are great benefits to technology and communication and having a camera and video camera at our fingertips and being able to stay in contact 24/7 with people. But there's a downfall. To share an experience that I had a while ago in Manhattan, I was walking down the street, a really busy street, and I saw a young guy buried in his phone, face down, on his phone texting, and he literally walked right into an intersection against traffic, and cars beeped, slammed on their brakes, and thankfully they stopped. So that was frightening to see, but what was most striking is he was totally unfazed. He didn't even look up. He just continued to do his texting and cross the street. So whatever he was working on or texting must have been mightily important, because he was unfazed. It's like the world around him didn't exist. And that's just one experience. I also see, if I'm at a social event or a networking, professional networking type event, people are buried in their phones. So good old-fashioned communication, like, hello, my name's Jonathan, nice to meet you, seems to be a bit of a lost art. And that, to me, is a problem.
What do you think it's doing to humans in general? I wouldn't want to say just one culture, because it doesn't seem to be limited to just the U.S.
I mean, in some ways, it's making people dumber. It's making our society dumber. Can people do basic things such as buying movie tickets? Can they actually go to a theater? Do they know how to make that transaction? can they get from point A to point B without relying on their device to tell them turn left, turn right, for go straight for 3 miles. I use a map if I need to look up directions, and then I can retain that information. So we've become very dependent on technology to get from point A to point B. I'm not so sure that's a good thing, because what if technology malfunctions? What if it's not available? Will a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old who is new to driving, will he or she know how to read a map if technology fails him or her?
So what's the answer? Because we're certainly not going backwards with our technology.
You're right. We're not getting rid of technology. You know, I think we just have to learn not to be so ruled by our phones, and we need to relearn how to appreciate people and spoken word. So there are some things that you can do, like which would be going back in time, but I think there's a richness to it. So, for example, if it's someone's birthday, pick up the phone, not texting them, but actually speak to them or send them a good old-fashioned greeting card. Like, there are some things that can just have so much more meaning than a little text message. And I think people can have a sort of a no-technology zone or time in their day. So, you know, maybe after 8 o'clock, you know, no phones, no devices, let's gather around the dinner table and speak, or, you know, enjoy loved one's company without a device. And then a lot of times at special events like weddings or parades or historic type events, people are so buried in their phones that they miss out on that moment in time, and it's hard to recapture that. As a matter of fact, you can't recapture that. You know, what's seen with the naked eye can be priceless. So a lot of people are missing out because they're too busy posting pictures to social media. So, yeah. You know, I think in many ways, just getting back to the basics can be really helpful.
All right. New York-based psychotherapist. You can, Jonathan Alpert. You can find him on Twitter at Jonathan Alpert. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it. Halloween is the spookiest day of the year in the United States, with people attending costume parties, visiting haunted attractions, and telling scary stories. But on October 31st, Halloween is also known for children going door-to-door in costumes, saying trick-or-treat and getting lots of candy. And traditionally, the only decoration has been, you know, a pumpkin or a jack-o'-lantern in the front of the house. But now more and more people than are elaborately decorating. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to some of the homes with Halloween in mind in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of Washington.
Big things are happening for Halloween at the Crist family home in Alexandria, Virginia, with ghastly creatures emerging out of the darkness.
Fire, burn, cauldron, bubble.
And then there are things just hanging around.
Pray for the dead, and the dead will pray for you.
A couple of weeks before Halloween, 32-year-old Nicole Crist, who lives with her father, starts putting up lights and other decorations.
My love for Halloween started when my dad used to take me to trick-or-treating every single year to these amazing houses. When I was 17 years old, I guess I just started decorating on my own.
And now she has a large collection of things that go bump in the night. She mostly purchased herself over the years.
It's a pretty expensive hobby, but it's well worth it. I enjoy doing it. This is my passion. I look forward to this each and every year.
As her collection grows, so do the number of people who come to the house to trick-or-treat on Halloween and look at the display. About 200 came last year.
I get a thrill out of people walking up the driveway, just their reactions. I really like, in the Halloween spirit, to scare people. When they get scared, it kind of makes me laugh.
Over at the Buffalo family home, the front yard has become a graveyard with zombies emerging from the earth. 13-year-old Will Buffalo has decked out the house with scary stuff.
And you can just let your imagination run wild, and it's the one time of year where you're allowed to sort of let loose and be kind of crazy and, you know, have some creepy, morbid stuff without people looking at you funny.
Halloween, or All Saints' Eve, is observed in other parts of the world as a time to remember the dead. So for a Ukrainian family who put just a few decorations on their house, The celebration of Halloween in the United States seems peculiar. The family came to Alexandria, Virginia, 8 months ago.
I was surprised, but I like it. I think it's a good chance for us and our children to have a good time, so we decided to decorate our house with this hanged skeleton and traditional pumpkin.
So whether it's a simple traditional pumpkin or an extravagant display, everyone of all ages can enjoy the fun of Halloween. Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Well, that's going to wrap up today's international edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
About 1 billion people, or every seventh person, suffers from at least one neglected tropical disease. Neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, are chronic disabling illnesses that thrive in areas with poor sanitation, lack of clean drinking water, and scant access to medication. NTDs have blinded, disabled, disfigured, and killed their victims for centuries, devastating individuals and entire communities. They affect the ability of children to thrive and to learn, and of adults to work, thus perpetuating the cycle of poverty. Nonetheless, most of these diseases are frequently preventable or treatable, often with low-cost medications. So 10 years ago, working through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the United States government launched a public-private partnership to treat those who suffer from NTDs and to help prevent contamination and spread of the parasites that cause them through improved sanitation, preventive treatments, and mass drug distribution campaigns. Working in partnership with the United Kingdom's Department for International Development, the Conrad Hilton Foundation, the Queen Elizabeth Diamond Jubilee Trust, and many more, USAID has been instrumental in the delivery of more than 1.6 billion treatments to prevent and treat seven of the most common NTDs. Some 743 million people across 25 countries directly benefited from these treatments. Much of the medication was donated by pharmaceutical companies, which have given over $11 billion worth of drugs free of charge to the countries where USAID supports mass treatment campaigns. Moving forward, over the next 5 years, USAID and its partners plan to provide 1.3 billion treatments, leverage $6 billion in donated drugs, and prevent more than 585 million cases of NTDs. The partners hope to eliminate trachoma, the world's leading cause of preventable blindness, lymphatic filariasis, a painful and disfiguring parasitic infection transmitted by mosquitoes, and to break the transmission of diseases like schistosomiasis by improving sanitation. Working together with our partners over the past 10 years, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith, we have figured out an approach that works, and freed over 100 million people from these parasitic worms and bacterial infections that have held communities back for too long. Now is the time to double down and reach scale.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for.